Good morning, everyone. I'm Mel.
And I'm Pippa. We're the creators and editors of Earthrights, the podcast and platform that focuses on the connection between human rights and environmental issues.
Just a quick message before we begin. The views and research presented on this podcast are either our own or referenced on our website, www.earthrights.co.uk. We generally always record a few weeks ahead of release, so some facts or situations may have changed during this time. Hey everyone, welcome to the Earthrights podcast. Today we're here with Frank Hernandez, who is a journalist for the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting, which is a non-profit newsroom in Champaign, in Illinois, and you cover agriculture and rural life in the United States. Frank is a recent graduate from the University of Texas at El Paso in philosophy and multimedia journalism. But Frank's hometown is Ciudad Juarez, which is a border town in Mexico, and is going to be the subject of our conversation today. Frank has experienced firsthand the changes and challenges of the Trump and now Biden administration. And we're going to be talking a lot in detail about the situation at the US-Mexico border and the asylum seeker crisis from a journalistic, but also amazingly, a first-hand perspective. So thanks so much for coming on, Frank.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Firstly, I think it's going to be good to get a bit of a background story on the US-Mexico border. So, Pippa, do you want to explain a little bit about the situation there?
Yeah, so the border between the US and Mexico was kind of formally established in 1848. And for much of history, kind of humans have flowed seamlessly between the border and through the space. And I guess the strains on the border began, evolved the strains on the border. But a notable point of strain is following the 9/11 attacks. So before September 11, the presidents Vincent Fox and George Bush intended to broker an agreement on immigration. But after the attacks, they abandoned these plans in favour of enhanced security and counterterrorism.
Just one question, Frank. When we're talking about the border of the cuts between USA and Mexico, I personally think of it as a physical border. Maybe portrayed through the news or whatever, but what does the border actually look like? Is it a physical barrier or what?
Right. So the US-Mexico border, like it's a big chunk of land. There are certain physical barriers, definitely especially between cities and places where there is high concentration of people. So, for example, in the border between El Paso and Ciudad Juarez, there is whole like physical structures that divide both cities, and this you can see it also like in different borders between Laredo, Nuevo Laredo, Tijuana, and San Diego. There's like different actual structures that, for a long time since the 90s, there were simply fences. But starting with the Trump administration, they became actual like metal barriers that divide certain parts of the border. This is especially where there's a lot of people or there's a high concentration of people. In other areas where there's like big part that's only desert or that there is not high concentration of people, this how the border looks in those places is a little bit different. So I would say there is a physical barrier between both countries, but this also depends on the conditions of the specific, like the environment and how many people are crossing or how many people can cross. It really varies from place to place.
Moving forward after the 9/11 attacks, like driven by like various reasons from violence, the presence of family and friends in the US, economic benefits, and also due to the impacts of climate crisis with excess droughts. millions of Central Americans have made their way to the US across the border. And this surge in the number of people making this journey led to the brutal crackdown by Donald Trump, who kind of has actively shown his opinion on asylum seekers crossing the border. And this led to kind of, as you explained a bit, Frank, with the his kind of promise to build a wall and make Mexico pay for it, even though President Enrique Peña Nieto maintained that Mexico would not pay for the wall. But Trump's promise has faced a host of legal and logistical challenges. And in 2018, the Trump administration secured $1.6 billion from Congress for projects at the border in order to kind of build this wall. So yeah, anyway, obviously this is an example of hostility towards asylum seekers in this period. And specifically, during this time, there was a host of human rights abuses. So the border agency implemented illegal and informal policy to push back asylum seekers along the entire border. And like pushbacks of this kind are illegal under US law and also violate obligations under international refugee law. And although the US has not publicly disclosed the number of families it forcibly separated, by halting the flow of people at the border, there are estimates that thousands of families were separated, with parents and guardians separated from their children. The US government also sought legal authority to indefinitely detain unaccompanied children and families, despite this being unlawful. And they also implemented official policy of mandatory and indefinite detention of asylum seekers without parole.
Can I just ask, where are the asylum seekers detained? Is there a specific detention centre at the border, or does it vary?
Right, so there is one detention center in El Paso or in Tornillo, which is like a small town near El Paso. And there are many of these all across the border, all like in different places in the US. Like this detention center in Tornillo became kind of relevant because there was a few, I believe two deaths of unaccompanied minors in one of these centers. And it's just been like this. There's been also like reports of sexual abuse. There's different things that have been happening in these places. That is for the asylum seekers that have made it to the U.S. On the other hand, with what the Trump administration sort of named the Remain, or how it became known, the Remain in Mexico policy, that made a lot of these asylum seekers, instead of being able to sort of get to the United States, they had to remain in Mexico to wait for their asylum process to be to go through. What this made is that, or like what many people thought that this meant was a way for the administration to not have to sort of deal with all these asylum seekers, because at some point after detaining them, according to the US law, they had to release them in order to process their case. In this way, they didn't have to deal with this, but they would just leave them in Mexico and give them like just a different deadline and a different deadline all the time, so that they didn't really process their case. This is something that activists have said mostly. And you can still see it. A lot of these people are still in migrant centers in Mexico, in Ciudad Juarez, for example. There's one, we call it Casa del Migrante, the migrant house. That's where like a lot of these migrants and asylum seekers are living right now and have been living for a couple of years now. This is, of course, after they were living actually in the border. So how it works, for example, there in Ciudad Juarez, there's different international bridges. And through there is how you cross from one country to the other. For about 1 or 2 months, the asylum seekers were actually living and sleeping in the bridge, with not more, most of them, they didn't have more than a couple of blankets and pillows. Some of them had tents, but that was just how it was. They were living there, waiting for like the US border authorities to let them cross to be able to ask for asylum. but this was just how it was. They couldn't really do it because of this policy, or this was actually before the policy, but they already sort of instituted some protocols to stop the asylum seekers from crossing to the United States. So they needed to stay in Mexico to wait for their case to be processed.
So yeah, fast forward a bit to present day with President Joe Biden being elected. And on his first day of office in January 2021, he ordered a pause in the construction of the wall and also pledged to unite families that has been separated and also promised to begin accepting asylum seekers again. But we'll go into this kind of in more detail a bit later. But first of all, Frank, can you kind of explain a bit more the reasons behind this mass migration? And specifically, are there any kind, well, as I mentioned, but can you sort of go into detail about the environmental factors leading to migration on this scale?
Yeah, there are environmental factors and environmental drivers of this migration. There are, I wouldn't say they're the main driver of the migration, because if you look at it, at what are the causes of it, it's mostly related to violence and gang violence in their home countries. Central America is known for having all these problems with gangs and just an increase of violent crime over the last decades. But this is, this is the main driver. There's also economical reasons. Among the economical reasons, many of these are related to environmental factors. With climate change, there's been like an increase in droughts, floods, and just extreme weather. So for a lot of these people that were, for example, like many of them, they probably owned land. They were probably farmers who had to just flee their country because of economical reasons, because it was just not sustainable to continue because of climate change. Other than that, there's also a lot of people from indigenous communities who have had to flee their countries just because, for instance, like in many of their ancestral lands, like big corporations, mostly like mining corporations and other kinds of corporations from the United States and Canada have sort of taken over these lands. So for many of these people, they have nowhere, they have nothing else to do. So what they have to do is just they leave their communities in order to like look for something better for just their families or their communities. So they decide to migrate. Among the reasons for people in these indigenous communities to flee is also violence. So there's been a lot of cases or there's been a lot of report of people from these communities, especially environmental activists from these communities, that they've been assassinated by presumably like paramilitary groups or sort of all this violent or organized crime that presumably are linked to a lot of these giant corporations.
I was just going to say, so environmental activists from the indigenous communities are being assassinated by the corporate giants from US and Canada.
I wouldn't say that's for sure. So this is some presumption. It hasn't been proven. There's a lot of reasons why it hasn't been actually proven. But there is some presumptions, and even among activists, what they say, just in general, what's the atmosphere there. It is a big problem of how many environmental activists have been murdered in Latin America. You just look like, for example, for me, that I've seen a little bit of the news in Mexico over the last 2 years, there's been about 30 or even more environmental activists been murdered, most of them coming from indigenous communities.
What's the, like with something like that, what's the reporting like in Mexico?
I mean, yeah, in general, there's a lot of sentiment in favor of these communities. If you look at the general public, on the other hand, this is not really a problem that the government, and doesn't really matter what administration has it been, it's been going on since decades, and really no administration from the Mexican government has taken this into their hands as an actual issue from environmental activists being assassinated. Adding to that, of course, Mexico is one of the countries with like the highest rates of journalists assassinations. So it's actually like way deeper than just how people look at it. It's a big problem that hasn't really been fixed, that it's still going on. Like the case that I feel like more familiar with that has to do with like this sort of problems between the original settlers or like people in small towns versus this like big corporations was this case in a small town near my hometown. So it's called Samalayuca. It's a couple of kilometers from Ciudad Juarez. It's about 30 minutes. So in this hometown, which is an agricultural town, most of the people there live on agriculture. They work in the fields, and that's what the economy there looks like. So in this area, there's like historically been a high concentration of copper, and there's this corporation, a Canadian mining corporation, who sort of got the permit and got the land to be able to mine in this area. Then the situation happened that the people living in this place, they didn't want this to happen just because of the high potential for contamination, for health problems derived from copper mining in the area. They sort of protested against the opening of the mine. They won an appeal to be able to sort of halt the project. But you can see that still, for example, the corporation still has it as a project for the future in their website. There's been a lot of sort of issues going on in there. And especially for the area, this is a sort of significant issue because during the 20th century, during a large part of the 20th century, including the 50s, and all the way to the 70s, 80s, copper production was a big thing in this area, in the border, Ciudad Juarez, El Paso area. There was this big plant from the Asarco Corporation, which it was a copper smelter. And just for a really long time, they were producing copper. They're extracting copper and just they process it in this smelter. And a lot of health problems derived from this. There was a lot of like an increased amount of cases of different types of cancer, respiratory issues, just a lot of things that were derived from this. So at some point in the, I believe in the 80s and 90s, sort of activists won an appeal to sort of stop production of copper in the area. After this happened for some time, sort of the smelter was there until it was demolished. And that was like this symbolic thing that finally like copper production in the area stopped until this VVC Exploration Corporation came and it was like, yeah, we're going to start working with copper again. And this sort of brought all these issues back to light and this became a bigger issue.
Just for like a bit of background, I probably should have said this earlier. So Frank and I actually met when we were studying in Prague. And during that period, well, I guess just before you came to Prague was just when Trump was elected. So when you kind of returned back to Mexico after your international studies, did you kind of notice any differences? Like how had things changed at the border? And yeah, like personally, was like, did you see that things were changing?
It's difficult to say how much they changed just because I experienced it sort of day by day. And it was not this all of a sudden change that, let's say like before Trump, I didn't experience any discrimination. After Trump, I experienced lots of discrimination. I don't think it was like that. I don't even think that I experienced direct discrimination in the way that I think, and I probably have heard of cases that asylum seekers experience discrimination. But I did feel when, for example, I remember the waiting time in the lines or the scrutiny that you went through, it was way lighter before Trump. And even during the first 1 or 2 years of Trump, it was not as bad as, for example, when the asylum seekers crisis began, that things really got, I feel like there was a lot of more stress and just anxiety in the whole process of crossing the border prior to maybe the asylum seekers crisis and then afterwards. I feel like there was some change in that. As I was telling you, I don't know how much was it like actual policy and how much it was the general atmosphere of the officers and everything, like if it was somehow related to their job or it was actually the administration's role in this. I don't know. I don't have a complete access into how much there was some influence from one side or the other. But there was, I think, if you somehow like go back and try to experience what it was and then sort of go forward and see how it was during the last years of the Trump administration, it was a little bit different in some ways. That's, of course, from my perspective as a student that was crossing the border. Of course, it was way different for people who sort of try to cross as an asylum seeker or as a refugee. They sort of had it way rougher.
So for being a student, you had to cross the border every day, I take it. And by crossing the border every day, what processes did you have to go through to do that? And what were the impacts at the peak of the asylum seeker crisis on you crossing the border each day?
So crossing the border each day, I feel like it might sound like really extreme. For me, it was at the beginning, it was probably staying in line for 1-2 hours. That was at the peak of the situation of the when the whole border crisis or the asylum seeker crisis began. That was probably like between 1 and 3 hours, how long the queues were. Before this, I remember when I started studying there, they had a special line for students. So you would go in, just show your student visa and you would go, and it was generally shorter, the waiting time. But probably a reasonable time being in line is between, it was prior to the whole asylum seekers crisis, it was somewhere between 30 minutes and probably 1.5 hours. After this, it was normal to see lines that were going on for like 2-3 hours. I know people that were in line for probably 5 or 6 hours at some point. And yeah, that was generally the bigger issue. Once you sort of pass the waiting time, just being there, it's quite straightforward. They check your documents and they let you in if your documents are okay. It's just the waiting time.
I think that is quite extreme to think, like, for many people it's hard to imagine that like every single day you would be waiting 3 hours. Like, that's not even traveling, like that's just standing in a line just to kind of get to your education. So yeah, I think it's kind of hard to imagine doing that day in, day out. Like, it must have been exhausting.
It gets exhausting after some time. I like to say, and I used to say, I got used to it after some time, because you do get used to it. You sort of manage to use your time for something else in the meantime, but it is exhausting. I remember like getting back or like going home and just wanting to like rest, because it was crossing the border one way and then crossing it back. Crossing to Mexico is not, it doesn't take that long, but it's still sort of like, having to do it every day, it was tough. It was sort of having to go through it. You get used to it. It's just, it does take your energy away.
And just like thinking about the asylum seekers crisis, like how did, and like it, on a more global scale, how did the UN and other kind of global institutions respond to what was going on?
Yeah, so I don't know. I feel like the UN, I barely ever saw anything that the UN put up. I feel like the UN hasn't really done much. I don't know how much can they do, but they definitely haven't said much about what's going on. To a certain degree, they probably did put up some statement when the whole asylum seekers crisis happened. But other than that, you didn't see much of an action from the UN regarding this issue. And in general, there hasn't been much attention, I feel, from the UN to this area. We've had, like, historically, there's been a lot of stuff going on here, and there hasn't been that much attention to it, as I think it should be. Of course, I'm saying it from a perspective that I'm from that area, and I'm saying the UN needs to, like, sort of pay more attention to these issues. But I think in general, just because of the magnitude of the issues, I feel like there is not sufficient world organizations or international organizations having given sufficient attention and support to fix these problems. I believe that's, like, from my personal perspective, but just experiencing that and seeing what's been going on, I think it's insufficient what they've done, and I think they can do way more. That's what I can say about that.
Yeah, and just thinking about that, when you were saying that the UN has kind of been silent on the refugee crisis at that border, what's the UN's reaction to, like, your city and where you grew up?
I don't know, and I don't think it's deliberate. I just feel like maybe it's just a blind spot that they haven't really gone into. Maybe it is deliberate, maybe it's by design. I wouldn't say it, just because I'm not sure about that. But I generally, I don't think that it's deliberate. I just think it's somehow like a failure from part of the UN on how much attention do they put to this. Yeah, and as you were saying, it is not right now one of the most dangerous places in the world. I believe it's somewhere in, like it's somewhere there in the ranking. I haven't looked into it that much, but I remember growing up during 2007 all the way to 2012, we were the most dangerous city in the world. So for some time, it was like the homicide capital of the world. And this is, like, at the same time, looking at places like Afghanistan, Iraq, like, where actual conflicts, like, were going on at this time. And it was like higher rates of homicides in this area. For all this time, I remember that at some point, like, there was, like, the UN was going to send some of the, like, I believe it's the Blue Velvets, how they call them, or I don't know, like, some kind of group to sort of manage the situation. I don't remember ever seeing something like this, like, ever, like, the UN coming and trying to do anything. It was more like they were putting out statements like that. And I don't want to, like, just sound like I'm just saying a lot of bad things about the UN. But I feel like in general, just from what I've seen in Juarez and what I've experienced and what I've seen from the UN or any international organization, it hasn't been like this big issue that they talk a lot about or that they put a lot of attention to.
If that's one of the main reasons people are leaving, it's just interesting that it has. Perhaps it's too dangerous. Perhaps it's something they're not sure how to resolve, because it's not like a conflict. It's violence, gang violence and stuff, which is a much sort of more deep societal problem.
Yeah. Growing up, was this something you were, like, aware of as a child and your family talked about? Like, was, like, violence in the streets and stuff just kind of part of the norm, or were you sort of sheltered from it?
No, yeah, it was. I remember in school, and even, like, with my parents talking about that, they would tell us, every once in a while, like, ways to sort of, like, what to do if there's a shooting, like, stuff like that. Like, they will tell you, you would learn about this growing up, like, just, like, you know, like, go to the floor, cover your head, sort of try to sort of guard yourself, protect yourself. And there were, like, things, like, that you had to learn. I did, like, a couple of times I did sort of, I was at some point, like, close to where a shooting happened. Fortunately, like, in none of these situations I was put into, like, real danger, but it was like a thing that people did experience in sort of regular, like it was regular, it was normal, like it was not out of the normal that you would experience or seen some murder in the streets or something like that.
Since Biden's become president, has his administration led to any noticeable differences in the border control and border checks and the general situation?
So there have been slight improvements. I feel like more generally in terms of what asylum seekers have to go through. So for instance, President Biden ended the Remain in Mexico program or Remain in Mexico policy. And I think this is a big step in the right direction. One of his other promises was to sort of begin accepting asylum seeker applications, which was something that the Trump administration, even though it wasn't openly saying, it was sort of in practice they were doing. They were not really sort of processing these cases. This is a promise that the Biden administration did. And this is, like, again, a step in the right direction. On the other hand, he also promised that during the first day, 100 days of his presidency or something like that, he was going to stop the deportations and sort of keep he was going to keep a watch eye on the immigration and customs enforcement, ICE, as it has become known. This is something that didn't really happen. So ICE keeps on sending people back to their countries, or even in cases to countries that are not even their countries. So there's been cases of people like African asylum seekers from different places in Africa, just different countries, who have been sent to Haiti or stuff like this. Like, just different cases like this have happened during these first days of the administration, of the Biden administration. So things like that, of just breaking this promise of stopping deportations, and it's something that just hasn't really stopped. Hopefully, like, in the next days, in the next few months, like, there is a real change. It is somehow like a step in the right direction to having ended this program, but at the same time, just seeing that these deportations continue to happen, that these sort of human rights abuses continue to happen, it's something that, even though you can attribute it all to the Biden administration, this was one of the promises that there was going to be a change in this. And even though it has been a change, we have to see just in some time, like, how much better is it going to be. And again, some of the big steps in the right direction was putting up sort of this agency or this program in charge of reuniting families, which is something that has happened. So a couple of days ago, the Biden administration was able to sort of bring, I don't remember the exact number, but I believe it's somewhere around 100 families together from those that were separated during the Trump administration. So there is some things that are sort of moving forward. There are some other things that we don't know how much or how long do we have to wait for this. On the other hand, on how did I experience crossing the border? Well, I haven't crossed the border since March just because of COVID, because the border is sort of closed. So I haven't been to the US since March. So I can't tell the difference between, because still today, like, the border is still closed for people who are not going for essential reasons.
And, like, speaking of that, like, how has the COVID pandemic impacted this situation? Like, obviously, if the border's closed, but yeah, what are the kind of wider implications?
So currently, the thing is a little bit better in the whole border area. I believe the last time I checked, and this was somewhere a couple of hours ago, that there were about 56 reported cases in Juarez. I don't know how many in El Paso, but it's also not a high number. And this is just talking about how many cases are active right now. In total, yeah, there's been a lot of cases, but right now, like, the situation is not bad. People are sort of having a normal life, as much normal as you can. Like people are still wearing masks, but sorry.
When you say cases, do you mean COVID cases or asylum cases? Okay.
Sorry. Yeah, COVID cases. So there is around 50 to 60 reported active cases, COVID cases in Juarez. And this has a lot to do with the fact that there's a lot of vaccinations going on, or like they've been vaccinating a lot of people in El Paso. This you can see it, and it's something remarkable because even though the border is technically closed, the border by land between U.S., Mexico, U.S., Canada, still, like, for example, in the U.S.-Mexico border, people coming from the U.S. can still cross to Mexico, even though people from Mexico cannot cross to the U.S. And this sort of impacted how many cases or how intense the situation in Juarez was. You can see just this, how it happened in September, October of the last year, when, you know, El Paso, there was a lot of cases, to the point that El Paso made sort of headlines all around the world of how terrible the situation was, that actually there was like some reports that the situation in El Paso back in September or October, I believe, was worse than how it was in New York at the beginning of the pandemic. So just how bad it was, you could see it reflected in Juarez at the same time that hospitals were at the point of almost collapsing, where there was no space for people in hospitals, that people had to wait in lines to get oxygen tanks just because it was not possible for them to even access the hospital because they were full. There was this point where the local government had to give away oxygen tanks because there were no more oxygen tanks. So people couldn't even access to this. So the situation was not good at this point. Fortunately, right now it's been under control for some time, a couple of months, sort of cases decreased. And this, I think it has sort of a lot to do with the vaccine and that people in El Paso mainly are getting vaccinated. So this is influencing a lot of how COVID has been developing in the border.
Yeah, that's really it's good that it's kind of the situation is getting better. But it's interesting, we actually wrote a blog post the other day looking at the importance of global vaccinations, and especially with refugees and people that might not necessarily have access to healthcare and stuff like that. So is that something that's being talked about in Mexico?
So right now in Mexico, no, just because vaccines are sort of starting in Mexico. It's not like a thing yet. I mean, yeah, there's a lot of people getting vaccinated, but it's not a high percentage of the population. Right now, it's like in Mexico, who's getting vaccinated is mostly healthcare personnel and people over 60, I believe. Over 60. So right now, like, there's not a big outreach to vaccinate the whole population. And that, of course, affects people in asylum or migrant shelters. Because if the general population doesn't have access to vaccines, it's even harder for them to get access to the vaccines. Mm. And this has mostly to do because there's no availability of vaccines yet in Mexico, as in much of Latin America and a lot of parts in the world.
Has the border been open then for vaccines, goods, other healthcare products? Because when you were saying that people were able to move from the US back to Mexico during the pandemic, but not from Mexico to the US, were any supplies or anything coming to help alleviate the situation?
Yeah, like goods have been traveling back and forth. That hasn't really stopped. Like there is economic exchange because there is a lot of economic dependency. There hasn't been a real stop on the transport of goods from one side to the other. There was like some criticism that, for example, a lot of the medical supplies produced in Mexico were going to the US, but at the same time, like the US did sort of give a lot of or send a lot of goods or medical supplies to Mexico. So it's just like the economic system is just too intricate, and there's a lot of stuff going on that it's more difficult than just like give blame to one country or the other, like how do goods are traveling, because they are just traveling back and forth. I don't know if you saw, but a couple of weeks ago, I believe it's 1 or 2 weeks ago, that the Mexican president did condemn the fact that a lot of rich countries, countries in Europe, the US, like first world countries, were sort of taking all the vaccines and leaving countries, the Mexican president focused in Latin America, but this is happening all around the world. You have like countries, a lot of countries in Africa, a lot of countries in Asia, which haven't even gotten one vaccine. Mm. And this is something that the Mexican president condemned internationally.
And it maybe shows the inequality or the imbalance of power between countries generally in an economic sense. And finally, to wrap up this episode, often we ask people what their takeaway would be. Is there anything that you think people should take away from this episode in terms of their learning and like that they could do to help support the situation at the border?
There's a lot of organizations that are working on the ground in the border, in both sides of the border. I could give you a list that I don't have like the names right now, but there's pretty much, if you look, I believe one of them is the Border Network for Human Rights or something like that. I don't remember the exact name, but that's one of the organizations that has been in the ground sort of working with migrants and working with asylum seekers, sort of providing all the supplies and sort of helping out. Other than them, and there's a lot of organizations, once you look into which organizations are working in the border, you're going to have a whole list of them. And working just different issues, including environmental issues. On the other hand, I think people should know more about and should learn more about what's going on in terms of the indigenous communities fighting this sort of this war against these multinational corporations that are sort of going to mainly in Latin America to sort of extract resources. And yeah, a big problem with this is that they go into these ancestral lands, which have like is the lands that they've lived for thousands and thousands of years. And there's still like these corporations that are sort of for economical reasons, which whether justified or not, they're still sort of affecting these communities in one way or another, which in many cases has led them to them having to flee their countries or even their states, and has contributed to a lot of this instability in the whole region. Mm. I think those are two of the most important things, just to sort of look at what these organizations are doing in the border, look at what has driven this migration, and look at how the dynamics between sort of economical interests against sort of these communities resisting these corporations.
It links very much to an episode we did in series one with Miles, which was entitled Oil or Life, and it was looking at the policy of extractivism in Ecuador and the kind of the trap it's in because of big corporations coming in to extract oil and the fallout with the indigenous communities who are obviously suffering the most from it. Well, thank you. And thanks so much for speaking with us generally today.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for inviting me. Just as a last thing, I wanted to say that just that everything that I said is sort of a disclaimer from my part, saying that this is my personal view, my personal opinion on all these issues. And that, for example, the Midwest Center is not directly linked to like these views. I'm not sort of reflecting on their views. This is sort of my experience and my personal views on some of these big issues that are way more complicated that I discuss them here, but it's my take from what I've experienced, what I've seen, what I've read, and what I've talked to other people who are actually in the ground doing this work.
If you are interested or concerned by any of the issues raised during this podcast, then please get in touch at contact@earthrights.co.uk or visit our website, www.earthrights.co.uk. You can find full recordings of all of the episodes on most podcast platforms or on the Earthrights website, referenced in the show notes. We host a blog on there too, as well as recommendations and other information. Please also join in on the journey by following our Twitter and Instagram accounts, @earthrights_.
If you would like to be involved in an episode of the Earthrights podcast, then please also get in touch. This Earthrights podcast was hosted, produced, and edited by us. Music and sounds were specially made for Earthrights by the Mowgli Wild Boys, who are currently recording a new LP at Circuit Studios in Nottingham. Please follow their Instagram and Facebook, @MowgliWildBoys.